Good morning. I call the State and Local Government Finance Policy Committee meeting to order on Tuesday, February 7th. There is a quorum present. We will move next to the approval of the minutes for February 2nd. Representative Newton, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the minutes of Thursday, February 2nd.
Okay. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the February 2nd minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. The next item on our agenda is House File 17. Representative Stevenson, it's good to see you again before the committee. Since you are not a member of the committee, I will move your bill. I will move that House File 17 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health Finance Committee. We now have the bill before us. Representative Stevenson, if you would please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 17 is a bill to deal with the exploding costs of prescription drugs in Minnesota. And, you know, I always like to start when I talk about this bill by reflecting on the fact that we've just come off a very heavy season of door knocking and engaging with our constituents, and I know that probably most members feel the same way that I do, that among the most memorable conversations I had with my constituents during the campaign was with people who were struggling with the cost of their medication, people who were making really terrible choices about whether to go without needed medications, whether to ration needed medications for themselves, for the loved ones, for their children. That shouldn't be the Minnesota that we live in. People should have the drugs they need to live and not go bankrupt having them. So it's a complex problem, prescription drug affordability, and there's not one solution. I like to say this is not a case where we need a silver bullet, it's where we need silver buckshot. And we have a couple different pieces of the puzzle in this bill. The first is, and the piece that's, I think, more squarely in the jurisdiction of the State Government Finance Committee relates to prescription drug price gouging. This portion of the bill gives new tools to the Attorney General to go after generic drugs that are price gouging on their costs. It's generics only on this portion of the bill, unfortunately, due to some case law on the federal level, which I think was incorrect, but we have to live with the reality of that. The other portion of the bill creates a prescription drug affordability board that I always analogize to the Public Utilities Commission. Just like the PUC protects Minnesotans from the monopolistic power of utilities, the prescription drug affordability board will protect Minnesotans from the monopolistic power of pharmaceutical companies. So that's kind of the bill in a nutshell. I do have an author's amendment, Madam Chair, that if you would be kind enough to move, I'd be happy to speak to.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. I move the A8 to be before the committee. Would you please speak to the A8?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the A8, as I mentioned, is an author's amendment that reflects a number of changes that stem from ongoing discussions that I'm having with stakeholders as this bill has moved now through two prior committees. It has one more to go, so we've got four committees here. So it makes a number of changes, you know, everything from changing some thresholds to dealing with some notification, some interactions between the Department of Health and various other agencies. It also changes the parent agency of the pharmaceutical of the affordability board from the Legislative Coordinating Commission to the Commissioner of Commerce, which resolves a constitutional question in the bill. I recognize that this amendment includes materials that are not within the jurisdiction of this committee. I hope the committee will still adopt the amendment because, as I mentioned, the bill's moving through a number of committees and we've had these ongoing stakeholder conversations. And it's good to get these changes into the record early as possible so that stakeholders can see what we're doing and the public can see what we're doing so that at the next committee stop, we can have an even more meaningful discussion with a lot more notice about what's going on going forward. So I would appreciate the committee's indulgence in adopting this author's amendment in its entirety, even though some pieces of it don't relate to the jurisdiction of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Is there any discussion to the A8?
Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author's admission, this is not exactly germane to our committee. I think that it would be better offered in the committee that it actually has the bulk of what's going on in the amendment there to discuss, because then the people who have been investing themselves in that subject matter area would be able to weigh in on it. My members are not on various committees that this is really the primary area of emphasis on. I would ask that the chair not engross this into the bill and wait for the next committee stop.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Is there any other discussion to the A8? With that, I appreciate your acknowledgement that not all of the parts of this amendment are in this committee, just as we asked you in your last bill to please put parts of our amendments at another committee stop. I will ask for all those in favor of adopting the A8, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the A8 is adopted. Please, now we can go to testifiers, if you wish. Okay. We have with us today, I see two testifiers. If we could bring forward Christina Moorhead, and she will be followed by Judy Cook. I ask that you please identify yourself for the record and then begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christina Moorhead. I'm here on behalf of Pharma. We represent the innovative biopharmaceutical research companies. So we agree today that too many patients are struggling to afford and access their medications. However, we disagree that the Prescription Drug Affordability Board in House File 17 is the solution. I've included in your handouts today other policy solutions that you may be interested in that other states have implemented and we think address patient out-of-pocket issues at the pharmacy counter. So my comments today are primarily going to focus on the Prescription Drug Affordability Board, whose purpose is to review drug manufacturer data to provide it to the state as part of the Prescription Drug Price Transparency Act to identify prescription drugs for cost review and to set an upper payment limit or price for prescription drugs. So while this sounds simple in concept, there are a number of issues with this, how the board will operate. So first, this Prescription Drug Affordability Board is required to review prescription drug data that exists but no one has yet seen. Two reports to the legislature from the Minnesota Department of Health are past due now, and no information has been made available to the public. I would urge this committee to consider delaying the implementation of this board until these reports are available, and we can understand if this data can even be used to accomplish the duties of this board. You've also heard today about patients struggling to afford and access their medications, which we agree with. However, this bill does not guarantee that patients will pay the upper payment limit for their medications. Please read page 12, line 31 very carefully that describes how a health plan must report how the UPL benefits enrollees, which is included but not limited to cost sharing. So we interpret this to mean that the health plan could use the UPL for other purposes than to lower the prescription drug cost at the counter for patients. And we see health insurers do this today with the rebates that our manufacturers provide to health plans, that they are used for other purposes than lowering the price for patients at the counter. Finally, please understand that House File 17 is a provider billing and payer reimbursement bill because it's setting the provision of what a provider can bill at the UPL and the amount a payer can reimburse at the UPL. But the bill does not set the original price of a prescription drug is sold for, which presents a number of issues in the supply chain, including if a provider can even purchase the drug at the UPL. So, Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to testify in the committee today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Moorhead. I appreciate your being here and for your important testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Moorhead? Seeing none, I would ask that. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. There was one question. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. And this is more of a comment, I guess, than a question. But, you know, I just wanted to level set here. And I really appreciate, Ms. Moorhead, that you provided us with some policies that are being seen in other states and how we might be able to employ some of those strategies to address the question of affordability. But I have to be really honest, this bill, and particularly the section in our purview today, has to do with price gouging. And I have to be really clear and really honest, none of the solutions on this page address the abuses of price gouging. And so while I really appreciate the other ideas that you brought forward, I just want to be clear to industry that this is not a solution for price gouging. And until the industry can handle that issue, we need to consider items like price gouging legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. I've done a little bit of research on this, and this bill is narrowed into the generic market. Can you help shine some light on the average price of generics over the last number of years? And for example, as I thought through the chair's bill, I thought to some of the prescriptions that I have gotten lately, and had a sinus infection late last year after all the fall dust, and I think I paid like $6 for my generic drugs, and I did not feel gouged in the least. Perhaps along those lines, you could maybe illuminate some of the things that the industry is doing relative to the price of generics, since that's the purview of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Moorhead.
So, Madam Chair, I'm with Pharma, and we represent the brand medicines. I think another testifier is with the generics. And just to clarify, my comments are specifically about the board and the setup of the board, which we thought was under the jurisdiction of this committee.
Thank you very much for your comments. Next, we will ask Ms. Cook to please come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Judy Cook on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, representing the generic and biosimilar manufacturers. AAM is opposed to House File 17. The first sections of the bill only apply to lower-cost generic drugs, not the brand drugs that are responsible for driving up costs for patients. This is misplaced. Generics and biosimilar medicines save patients money. They are 91% of prescriptions filled, but only 18% of drug spending, and make up only 2% of total healthcare spending. The bill does not address the cost drivers in the prescription drug marketplace. It allows the Attorney General to sue a generic company when the wholesale cost, not the patient cost, increases by $30. But no suit will be filed for a drug that is increased by thousands of dollars a month. The bill also protects any other entity along the supply chain who subsequently sells a generic drug, which substantially increases the cost to consumers. These provisions also have constitutional conflicts that will likely result in a lawsuit against the state similar to the one that has been filed in another state, not a good use of taxpayer dollars. The fiscal note we just saw is acknowledging the possibility of a lawsuit, but does not identify the cost to the state. Though the fiscal note from the same bill in 2021 noted that the state of Maryland had to pay AAM attorney fees when their factually similar law was found unconstitutional, in addition to the Office of Attorney General costs for the lawsuit. Also for this committee, the bill requires all generic manufacturers to maintain a registered agent and office in Minnesota, an attempt to get around the issues of concern with the Maryland case, but it does not work, and will force hundreds of generic companies to register with the Minnesota Secretary of State, even though their business is headquartered in another state and has no operations here. Overall, this is a bill that will cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars while providing false hope to Minnesota consumers regarding the cost of prescription drugs. Even more puzzling is the amendment added today, which changes the Drug Affordability Board to focus on generics by reducing the thresholds for board review to be much lower for low-cost generics than for brand drugs. Why would you want the board to review a lower-cost version of a drug and not the higher-cost one? It just doesn't make sense. And we look forward to talking further with the chair about, with the author about this. This is different from the other states who have affordability boards. The intent of the affordability board should be to focus on drugs that drive higher out-of-pocket costs for patients, not generic drugs, which time and time again have proven to lower patient costs. As amended, the bill is almost entirely focused on generics instead of higher-priced brand drugs. We encourage you to not adopt the generic drug price gouging, or now, as amended, the entirety of House File 17. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. And I don't know if you heard the question from Representative Nash that was asked about generic drugs and just a moment ago to Ms. Moorhead.
So as I stated, there generic drugs are 91% of prescriptions filled, but only 18% of drug spending. The average copay is about, on a generic drug, is about $6. It's hard to have the average cost of a generic drugs because generic drugs, sorry, I hope you'll let
That's
me just
fine.
Chat for a second.
Please.
So the generic drugs are actually sold by the manufacturer to the wholesaler. It's a competitive marketplace. And then the wholesaler will sell it to the pharmacies. Most of these transactions occur outside the state of Minnesota. And frankly, the irony of this bill is that the manufacturers you would impact the most are Minnesota-based generic manufacturers should this bill survive a constitutional challenge. So, again, you know, we really feel like this is very misplaced.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Representative Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And also, I just want to say that I'm happy to continue talking with you about this and particularly changes related today. I did have some information that was responsive to Representative Nash's question about generic price increases, and there are a few examples. We do, I have been struggling with a cold recently, and I have been benefiting from the fine work of the generic drug industry, and I appreciate that very much. But I think we need to think less about what we take when we have a cold and maybe more what we take when we have a more specialized circumstance. So here's a few examples. For example, in 2015, Turing Pharmaceutical, this is Martin Shkreli's famous company, raised the price of off-patent Daraprim, which is a life-saving drug used to protect HIV-AIDS patients from the parasitic disease toxoplasmosis, from $1,350 to $750 per pill. That's a 5,000% increase overnight. Fluoxetine, a liquid version of generic Prozac, in the first quarter of 2019, the price jumped from $9 to $69, an increase of 667%. I'm not going to get the pronunciation of this right, I doubt. Guanfacine, which is a generic ADHD treatment, in the first quarter of 2019, its price jumped from $29 to $87, an increase of 204%. Azacitidine, which is a generic version of a chemotherapy drug, Vidaza, in the first quarter of 2019, its price jumped from $105 to $210, an increase of 100%. Most pharmaceutical companies do the right thing. I'm not arguing otherwise, and the price of generic Sudafed is very achievable for someone like me who's suffering with a cold. But there are instances, demonstrable instances, of extreme price increases even in the generic marketplace.
Thank you. And Ms. Cook has indicated that she would like to make another comment. Ms. Cook.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to remind everybody that what Martin Shkreli did was already illegal, and he went to jail for that. And it was an off-label patent brand drug. It was not a generic. Regarding fluoxetine, again, it's a competitive marketplace. So if one manufacturer happens to raise the price, it is not probably the price that you're going to pay in the marketplace. There's multiple, probably a dozen from time to time, generic manufacturers of fluoxetine, which is generic Prozac. And most frequently, you can find that in the marketplace for around $10-ish for a 30-month supply. The last drug I think you mentioned, I'm trying to remember all the drugs, was, I'm not sure there's a generic because I looked that one up. Yeah, we'll use that. That is actually an injectable drug. I'm not sure there's a generic for that one, but it is an injectable and not a drug that you would actually purchase at a pharmacy. So I think if we want to focus on the drugs that are, you know, that our consumers are buying at the marketplace, again, I just am going to suggest this is misplaced.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Say, Representative Stevenson, so we're going after generic drugs, not the brand names, you know, and as we talk about, you know, lawsuits or things like this coming to us, you know, I sure hope we don't end up with a lawsuit. I hope we've done our background. You know, it seems like when we move fast like this and do a lot of things, we end up with lawsuits, and we ended up with that already happening on a bill that moved through the floor. We have a lawsuit coming to us. And I don't want to see, you know, we're trying to cut the prices and watch prices and help people. We're not doing any tax relief, but we're trying to do all these things and moving fast, but it's costing taxpayers. So I hope in when we're looking at this and we're studying this and take and testify, we take it to heart that, you know, make sure it's not costing taxpayers more when we're doing things like this, because I feel some of these things we're moving through, we have great ideas and we want to do it and we want to try to help, but it's costing us money. And we just saw that happen. So that's just my comment on it. Thank you.
Are there any further individual, oh, Representative Nash, did you want to speak one more time to the bill?
To the bill, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I do not know of any more amendments or anyone else who from the public who wishes to testify. Is anyone from the public who wishes to testify? Okay, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wanted to direct members' attention to the fiscal note, the preliminary fiscal note that we got last night. Page 10, it is paragraph 5, bottom line, and this is where one sentence actually is a fairly significant game changer. As you're turning there, I'll read it to you. It says, last line, it said, it should be noted that there are potential secondary costs associated with this bill if it faces pre-enforcement challenge to its constitutionality. Ms. Cook just referenced the challenge in another state of a really morphologically similar bill, and it was questioned on its constitutionality. Ultimately, that state lost. There is zero appropriation in this bill to cover potential legal costs. I believe the fiscal note for this, the last biennium, said that that was going to be somewhere in the $200,000 range of pre-funding that, because it will get challenged. And I guess I'm just, because the AG is in our purview,
yep,
I think that that's sort of a woefully lacking exercise, that we haven't even recognized the fact that you will get sued, the state will get sued. Just like we said on the blackout bill, we would get sued, and lo and behold, we're getting sued. So I'm just trying to figure out, you know, the LBO appropriately and accurately forecasted that in that particular paragraph, and I'm wondering why the author has not addressed that in the bill.
Representative Nash, on page 11, it says long-term fiscal considerations. It does say that that's staffing and expert mm-hmm. revenue is there, but I'll ask you, Representative Stevenson, if you wish to speak to that comment.
Yeah, I'll speak on a couple levels. It's my, in the time that I have been here, we usually do not incorporate an appropriation into bills to fund potential litigation related to the constitutionality of the bill. In fact, I can't think of a time that we've done that, and it's, as I'm sure everybody knows, pretty common for people to threaten to sue or actually sue on bills. And it's, I think, particularly common for industries that are seeing, frankly, you know, really substantial accountability measures that could cut into their profit margins, threaten legal action. I'm not surprised by that. You know, they have it pretty good under the current state of situation, and I expect them to do everything in their power to try and preserve the status quo. But we don't generally appropriate money to fund litigation in that manner on a bill-by-bill basis. We didn't in prior years. I don't have the last year's fiscal note in front of me, so I can't reflect how that was written in the fiscal note, but I will say it wasn't in the appropriation language when this bill passed the House. I think it's passed the House in both years of the last biennium. I think we included it in both the House omnibus, health omnibus in 2022 and 21. And so it's just not typically the way we operate and the way that we do these things. I will also say that both the Federal Circuit decision and the Maryland decision related to similar proposals in other states are litigation that we have learned from and adapted to and made changes to this bill to reflect. So that's not to say that the pharmaceutical companies aren't going to sue the state of Minnesota if we try and go after them for price gouging. I'm quite confident they will. But it is to say that we have modified the bill to reflect the decisions in Maryland and the Federal Circuit.
And Madam Chair, to follow up on that.
You have three other members on your team who want to ask. Okay, please go
thank
ahead.
You, Madam Chair. Well, I do happen to have the fiscal note from the previous biennium. And on its page 8, section 3, it does articulate that those costs would be in the $200,000 range. So it's obviously been something that's known for quite some time. Again, this is something that has been litigated in other states. The similar approach has lost in other states. In a previous version of the fiscal note, it was articulated at $200,000. And, you know, I trust the work of the LBO. They have consistently proven to do fantastic work since their inception. And I just am a little surprised at how, having learned from that, it would not be addressed in some of your future efforts. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. We will go to Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned that, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for being here and bringing it forward. I think we all are concerned about trying to reduce the cost of health care, and hopefully this will be part of it. You mentioned that there was a similar bill in Maryland that was ruled unconstitutional, and you said that that informed your decision in drafting this bill. Can you specifically point to what was changed this is model legislation that's happening across the country. Is that not correct?
Representative Stevenson.
Well, I would not describe this as model legislation, no. Because we have made it Minnesota specific. It is true that other states, and there's two distinct portions of the bill. There's the price gouging component and there's the affordability board component. Several states have now adopted affordability boards, including Maryland, including Colorado, including a few other states. Each board looks a little different. Ours looks a little different from the other ones. Price gouging laws have been implemented in other states, including the District of Columbia, which gave rise to the Federal Circuit litigation that we discussed here. So, you know, one of the modifications we made, for example, to the price gouging provision of the bill, and just, I'm sorry, I'm just skipping ahead to what
yep.
I inferred you were asking me.
I am. Thank you.
One of the things that we changed is that it's very clear that we are preempted from doing price gouging legislation on brand name drugs. And when this bill passed the House back in 2019, in my first year in the legislature, when Representative Lesch was carrying the bill, it included brand name drugs in that bill. But we have taken them out. It's not because I don't think that there's price gouging going on with brand name drugs. It's because we're trying to be responsive to court decisions from other places around the country. So that's an example. You know, I wish we didn't have to do it, but that's, you know, the nature of a federal system.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that. So can you point to any of the other, and I appreciate you modifying that model legislation. I think that's great. Can you point to any of the other states that have enacted this, along with the prescription board, that have actually resulted in a reduction or more affordability in generics? Has this actually produced the outcome that we're intending to try to produce?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. So this is a fairly new approach. The affordability boards that are in have been passed in other states have not yet, while they exist, they have not yet set the upper payment limits that this bill contemplates in those respective states. Part of the reason why is because of the lawsuits that we've been talking about, and because, as I said a minute ago, the pharmaceutical industry will oppose these efforts at every possible turn. So it is too early to give you the information you were looking for.
Thank you very much.
Just one follow-up.
Please may move on to Representative Harder, and then if we have time, we'll come back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for this bill. Generally, when government gets involved in situations like this, we all end up paying more because government thinks that they know what's best for the citizens, and it drives up costs. So you have to look at the Affordable Care Act. All of our costs went up, not doing what it intended to do. And so with generic drugs, which I like, I can go to Mexico and get a prescription made by an American company for $10. The same prescription that I get here in America, in Minnesota, cost me nearly $75. And the difference there might not be the generic drug that costs, but it could be the plan that I'm on. And therefore, it costs more. So while I appreciate trying to help people, I have not seen the data where this bill is a 911 that we need to hurry up to get it through because everybody is paying so much more. We're paying more on everything because of inflation. But I do have two questions. So here, the first one, does this bill apply to businesses outside of Minnesota? And my second question is, the members that are appointed by the governor, should they have legislative approval?
Representative Stevenson.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Harder, your first question, does this bill apply to companies outside of Minnesota? The bill, in the generic aspect of the bill, the price gouging aspect of the bill requires companies that are selling products, well, that products are available in Minnesota to establish a registered agent in Minnesota. This is a very common requirement and practice in law to require registered agents in states. There you will find whole listings if you go look at the Secretary of State's Office of registered agents that represent different companies to allow them to receive service and do other things according to law. So these are businesses that are having their products sold in Minnesota that will have a registered agent in Minnesota that will be doing business in Minnesota. As to the Affordability Board, the Affordability Board sets an upper payment limit. It regulates the amount that certain entities can pay for drugs, not how much companies can charge for drugs, if that makes sense as an answer to your question. As to your other question about appointments by the governor being having legislative approval, there is nothing in the bill currently requiring Senate confirmation. I'm just looking to make sure. So I don't believe that we would. We did have, in prior versions of this bill, we did have a system where various members were appointed by various different people, and we switched it over to the governor. That was actually in response to some constitutional questions, and I can't remember if it was litigation-driven or just, you know, people worried about potential litigation. But that is another area where we did kind of make a change in response to some constitutional questions. But currently, there's nothing in here requiring the Senate to confirm the members of the board.
Representative Nadeau, I'll give you the last question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And back to my follow-up on, you had mentioned that I was trying to get to the point where have these efforts in other states actually driven the cost down, reduced costs to people. Mm-hmm. And you said it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, you said it might be too early to be able to determine that because of the threats of lawsuits. And so we also just recently, or a few years ago, the legislature passed a bill that on price transparency that the Department of Health is supposed to report on. If it's too early to know whether or not this initiative is actually going to drive the cost of prescription drugs down, if it's too early because the Department of Health hasn't even done the transparency issues that we've pointed out, is it too early for this bill to actually be coming to this body? It just seems like there's a massive amount of unknowns, and the Minnesota companies that have testified are not in favor of your bill. And I'm just curious how you rectify that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
I don't think it's too early, Representative Doe, Madam Chair. In fact, here's what we do know. We know that across Minnesota, thousands of Minnesotans are struggling to afford their medication. They are skipping pills. They are cutting pills in half. They are foregoing food in many cases, making choices about whether to pay the rent or pay for their meds, pay for food, pay for their rents. That are the kind of choices that we all heard when we were out talking to constituents, and that's what this bill is trying to address. I'm not willing to wait until it's convenient for the pharmaceutical industry, until all of the legal challenges that they will bring up inevitably are resolved, until every last report has been done, because that process will continue forever. There is never a point in time where these companies are going to willingly say, we will cut our profits dramatically. It's just not going to happen. And if we wait for that, we're never going to take any action. We need to help the people in our districts who are struggling with the high costs of pharmaceuticals. When we see prices go up hundreds, thousands of percent, that's not acceptable behavior. When the EpiPen goes up 400% overnight, it's not because it got 400% more expensive to make the EpiPen. It's because the manufacturer realized that people needed it to live and would pay anything to get it. That's wrong, and we should do something about that, and we shouldn't wait for a report, and we shouldn't wait to see if it works in Colorado. We should take action now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. Setting upper payment limits, I mean, if they work here, then why wouldn't you carry a bill to set the price of cement? I mean, everything costs money, Representative. And basically, to go out there and just say, we're just going to set upper payment limits, just randomly, we're going to appoint a board, and we're going to do this, and we're going to hope for the best. We're going to disregard the investments into brand name drugs. We're going to disregard what innovation might come from these things. We're going to disregard these things, completely disregard these things. And we're just going to go down this road regardless of the people that oppose it. I just think it's too early, it's too arrogant, and it's a tough bill.
Thank you. Representative Nash, just 1 minute in closing comment, please, so we can move on. We have a lot of testifiers. Well, on the
Madam, I understand, but it is customary to allow the lead to close.
I'm
going to be requesting a roll call on this, and would point out that there's a number of funding issues that that create problems for this. The transparency webpage that Representative Nadeau just referenced had a fiscal note of $140,000 in the previous biennium. They're currently with a vendor called 10 to 11, actually now running at $719,436. This is just another open-ended checkbook to pursue a problem that, in our estimation, doesn't really exist in the generic market. It's a bill that is actually trying to create a solution for a problem that doesn't exist in that particular market. So we could go on for a lot longer, but the chair will not allow us to do so. So in respect for that, I urge members to vote no, as I will as well.
Thank you. And Representative Stevenson, I'm going to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a bill that is long overdue. It is a bill that our constituents are begging for. As someone who has used generic inhalers for decades, I can tell you I take the exact same medicine I took 40 years ago, and the price has gone up exponentially. So thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. And with that, I renew my motion to recommend House File 17, as amended, be re-referred to the Health Finance Committee. A roll call has been requested. Will the clerk please take the roll?
Chair Cleburne?
Aye.
Chair Cleburne, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt, absent. Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Nash, no. Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Bonner, aye. Representative Berg?
Aye.
Representative Berg, aye. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Representative Hansen, aye. Representative Harder?
No.
Representative Harder, no. Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Herr, aye. Representative Joy?
No.
Representative Joy, no. Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Kosnick, no. Representative Nadeau?
No.
Representative Nadeau, no. Representative Newton?
Aye.
Representative Newton, aye. Madam Chair, the ayes are 7 and the noes are 5.
And I would just like to make reference that Representative Hewitt is excused and not absent.
Excused. My apologies.
Thank you very much. And with 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. And House File 17, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Health Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Now, I'm going to move to the testifier table to present the next bill. I will ask Representative Newton to please take over as chair of the committee.
Welcome to your committee, Madam Chair. We have House File 979 before us. If you would like to tell us about your bill, please.
Apologies, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we have the bill before us. If it's going to be held over for possible inclusion, if you would please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And today I'm bringing forward House File 979. It is an task force for a legislative task force on aging. Minnesota has an aging population, and according to our state demographer, Minnesota's 65 plus population was nearly a million Minnesotans during the 2020 census. That's one in six Minnesotans is over the age of 65. In 20 years from now, Minnesota will hit peak retirement to working age ratio, with nearly two retirement-aged adults for every five working-aged Minnesotans. This impact is already being felt in Greater Minnesota, which is aging faster than the metro area. This huge demographic shift will have widespread impact on Minnesota's economy, healthcare system, and our social services. In the short term, one-third of older adult-headed households are already paying an unaffordable amount for housing. A quarter of the 65 to 75-year-olds are still in the workforce. Minnesota is facing a projected workforce shortage in 2024. We will have 3.1 million jobs, yet we will only have 2.7 million working-age adults employed. Long-term, Minnesota will see a significant shift in healthcare costs and social services. It is past time to begin thinking about these issues and how we will address them. This bill will get our work going in earnest. What is working well in Minnesota related to older adults? Where is the support needed? Who will be responsible for leading these efforts? And how should Minnesota move forward in assisting older Minnesotans to age in community and live fully with dignity? This bill establishes a legislative task force on aging. The purpose of the task force is to review and develop state resources for the aging demographic. The second purpose is to identify and prioritize necessary support for the aging population through statewide and local endeavors for people to remain in their communities. And thirdly, it is to ensure that all age-related state policies are inclusive of race, gender, ethnicity, culture, sexual orientation, abilities, and other characteristics that reflect the full population of the state. The task force will consist of eight members appointed as provided in Subdivision 3 of the bill, and it sets out meeting requirements and standards related to member expense, reimbursement, per diem. Those are all included in Subdivisions 4 and 5. The reason the bill is being laid over for possible inclusion is we didn't get the fiscal note until late last night, and I wanted to make sure that we had the ability to review the appropriation before going forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, that is a presentation on the bill. We have many testifiers who are coming forward. I'm going to ask that they please keep their comments to 90 seconds, but I ask your indulgence to let them finish if that time comes before they finish.
Good. Thank you, Representative Claiborne. And we have 12 testifiers that we have on the list here. So I'd appreciate it if we could have Chris Sundberg and Ann Busey come forward and pull up another chair so that we can move this along quickly.
Good morning. I would like to let you know that Ms. Sundberg called this morning and said she would not be able to come. Oh, okay. And so this is Nancy Hagen.
Haugen.
Thank you, if you'll let down the papers.
Mm-hmm. And is Ann Busey here? Okay, so that gets it down to 10. Ms. Haugen, please proceed with your testimony. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Nancy Haugen, President of Elder Voice Advocates. I am an RN public health nurse in Minnesota and hold a Master of Science degree in mental health nursing. Thank you, Representative Claiborne, for authorizing this critically important legislation. I am Chris Sundberg. I am representing Chris and reading her remarks. The executive director and a founding member of Elder Voice Advocates and Elder Care IQ. In our advocacy work, we have learned how pervasive the challenges are to age safely in communities of our choosing with qualified services and infrastructure. The crisis for our rapidly aging citizens is at the breaking point on many fronts, and we must act now. For the first time, this task force will make a holistic review of the entire spectrum of age-related issues. Our current fragmented approach has evolved over the years to address one set of issues at a time rather than by an all-inclusive plan. This has resulted in the present challenges for elders to access affordable housing and health care, transportation, trained workforce, caregiver support, state and local support services, and quality care in long-term care residences. Elder Voice Advocates sent out a notice regarding this bill to hundreds of our supporters throughout the state last week. The responses have been overwhelmingly positive, and here are a couple of examples of what they had to say. Fran Levings from New Dosey Township in northern Minnesota is vice chair of the North Pine Area Hospital District and chairs the Healthcare Needs Committee, and she states the following. This task force on aging is critically important to rural seniors. Pine County's older residents are lower income, and they struggle to pay for food, to keep up their homes, find transportation to doctor's appointments, find home health care services, get access to reliable broadband, and much more. Over 22% of
Ms. Morgan, if you could wrap it up, please.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I will do Tony Wagner, Nancy Jorgensen, and other residents of a suburban independent living apartment organized to fight a 14% rent increase. They were able to pressure the management to lower the rate to 9%. But Tony says we remain concerned that these are raising at alarming rates. And putting more pressure on Tony is an increase of $800 a month for his wife's memory care. His ability to pay for these increases has diminished greatly. We ask you to please support this much needed work. Today and tomorrow's elders are depending on your leadership and action. And we ask you to remember that we are all elders in training. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you for your testimony. And Ann Busey's not here. Kathy Kelso. And she'd be followed by Dr. Joseph Gagler. He's present. Yes, if you'd like to come up here. Ms. Kelso, if you'd like to proceed with your testimony, identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathy Kelso, and I am a volunteer advocate with Elder Advocates, with the Elder Voice Advocates. We ask for your support for House File 979 because we are all aging. We must ask ourselves, how and where do I want to live in my community as I age? Not aging in place in isolation, but in my community. The legislative task force is necessary to conduct a public review of aging with people across Minnesota to examine priorities that support aging in their communities. It is necessary to recommend a statewide plan of action, legislative proposals, and an entity such as an agency or office to implement those policies for aging in communities across Minnesota. Necessary to recommend private and public investments throughout the state to build and sustain a supported infrastructure for safe and affordable housing options, transit, health care, and local community-based resources for aging. As Representative Cleburne said, the demographer, state demographer, has said that we will have 1 million people over the age of 65 this year in 2023. In seven short years, we will have over 300,000 people over the age of 75. Where and how will all these people live? The task force will propose a course of action across generation, a multi-statewide plan, multi-year statewide plan for generations to come. Our state requires an economic development model for aging that would include private and public partnerships that attract long-term investments in time, attention, and resources across our state. The Legislative Task Force on Aging is a first step toward a multi-year Minnesota statewide plan for aging, which to be successful must reach scale with statewide participation and with every system that supports community life as we age. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Dr. Gogler, is it?
Mm-hmm. Close enough.
Trevor Turner.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, for the opportunity to speak briefly with you here today. My name is Joe Gogler. I'm a professor in the School of Public Health, where I direct the Center for Healthy Aging and Innovation at the University of Minnesota. And our center would enthusiastically participate in this task force. And the reason why, I think, is this. When I think of not just the challenges but opportunities that an aging state poses for all of us, the word that comes to mind to me is the importance of integration and coordination. Integration and coordination across entities or organizations and others that may be heretofore, historically, we haven't necessarily associated with helping older people or providing services to them. But as you heard from some of the testimony, and as I think you'll hear from subsequent testimony, in order for us to address what's really a seismic demographic change in the state of Minnesota, something we have never seen nor experienced, it will require this level of coordination and effort to successfully address. So for these reasons, our center will happily serve on this task force and hopefully serve as a resource, not just to all of you, but to the state of Minnesota to help us achieve an age-friendly state.
Thank you, Doctor. Now we have Trevor Turner, is it? Followed by Patrick McFarland, if you'd like to come down, Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Trevor Turner, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. The Minnesota Council on Disability supports House File 979, which establishes a task force on aging to review and prioritize the resources to support an aging demographic in Minnesota. So according to the Minnesota State Demographic Center, approximately a third of those 65 plus have a disability, which is much higher than all the other age groups. That percentage climbs exponentially higher as you increase in the age past 65. As Minnesotans age, they acquire disabilities such as vision loss, hearing loss, limited mobility, and cognitive disabilities. The number of Minnesotans turning 65 this decade will be greater than the past four decades combined. Around 2020, Minnesota's 65 plus population eclipsed the 5 to 17 population for the first time in the state's history. The total number of older adults is anticipated to double between 2010 and 2030. By then, more than 1 in 5 Minnesotans will be an older adult, including all baby boomers. Minnesota's aging population is growing, which means that the population of Minnesotans with disabilities is also growing. If you are fortunate to live long enough, you will acquire a disability. This is why a task force on aging is important to identify policies that will address the growing needs that come from aging, from aging disabled populations. The Minnesota Council on Disability believes that regardless of age, Minnesotans have a right to live, work, and play in the community of their choice. This, however, is threatened by the increasingly inadequate funded services that support the independence of Minnesotans with disabilities, especially those who are 65 plus. We are already experiencing a home care workforce crisis, shortage crisis, which is only exacerbated by an aging state. We must look for the solution that will alleviate the strain on our services, and a task force on aging goes forward to the right direction. Please support House File 979 and support the future of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleburne, for carrying the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. And Mr. McFarland and then Mary Jo Shifsky, if she would come down. It's nice to see you, Patrick.
Nice.
Please
to
identify yourself for the record.
I'm Patrick McFarland, a member of the Minnesota Board on Aging. Representing the board, I chair co-chair the legislative committee, the public policy committee. This is our top legislative priority. Mr. Chairman, House File 979, we would appreciate your support on that, urge you to pass this inclusion.
Thank you.
And my day job, by the way, is I'm the director of Anoka County Community Action Program. Yeah, and it was nice to see that you got promoted to the House representative.
We think so, too.
Thank you very much.
We both used to have hair colored other than white.
Thank you, Mr.
Mishifsky, and then Leif Greena, if he would come down, please. Mishifsky, if you would give us your name and then proceed with your testimony, please.
Hello, and thank you for hearing me. My name is Mary Jo Shifsky. I'm an appointed member to the Minnesota Board on Aging, or MBA. I joined the board because I wanted to help work on policy, because I know, and I've known for a long time, about how many more old people we're going to have in our state, including me, now and over the next 20 years. MBA, as you know, functions as the state board, or the state unit on aging. It is located within the Department of Human Services. In my 3.5 years as a volunteer board member, I've observed the threefold mission of MBA, which is advocacy, advice, and administration, reduced to a single focus. What the MBA does, it administers the Older American Act funding, which is a noble effort, millions and millions of dollars, into all the social service needs that are served by the state, that are offered by the state of Minnesota to all the elderly adults. But there's no time on the board to focus on advising or advocating. And as a result, I repeatedly hear negative comments among my aging colleagues in the community about why isn't MBA doing this and why isn't MBA doing that. Policy development, planning, and consistent community collaboration isn't a priority with the MBA because of the fact that we can't really work independently of the Department of Human Services and its priorities, which are really service, and a lack of capacity. We have 25 volunteer members, a very limited amount of staff, and planning and collaboration has fallen by the wayside during the time I have been on the board, which has made me sad and frustrated. I work with Patrick on the Public Policy Committee, and we are very grateful to be at this point with this initiative. Thank you for forwarding it, and thank you for listening to me today.
Thank you, Ms. Shifsky. And Mr. Greena, and followed by Louise Sundine, if you'd like to come forward, Louise.
And Mr. Chair, well, we have some questions for the testifiers from the Board of Aging. That we have some kind of follow-up questions on that, so hopefully we will have time for that, and if they'll stick around.
After we hear all the testifiers. So, Mr. Greena, if you'd like to proceed, please.
Morning.
Identify yourself.
And thank you for the opportunity to address something that my organization feels very strongly about. My name is Leif Greena. I am 70 years old. I have survived 70 trips around the sun. And I serve as president of the Minneapolis Regional Retirees Council, which is a constituent body of the Minneapolis Regional Labor Federation. Aging, it has been said, ain't for the faint of heart, as it is fraught with a variety of challenges which never bother to let you know they're coming. But what's coming for Minnesota, we do know. It has been called a silver tsunami. A tsunami's disruptive force arises from an overwhelming everything in its path. So if getting old ain't for the faint of heart, neither is a tsunami. But this is where we're now at, facing a silver tsunami, waiting for it to happen. It's like standing on the beach, waiting for the approaching storm, waiting for it to hit you, rather than taking safe shelter, well-provisioned, to ride it out. Now, some may ask, why study the need for a department? Can't we just reconfigure the Board of Aging? A fair question, one that this task force will no doubt address. There may be those who will cry, this is but a slippery slope to yet another expensive bureaucracy. Well, we already have a bureaucracy, It's just scattered across many agencies and departments, under-resourced, with no focused, coordinated leadership. Elders in Minnesota are highly engaged in the public arena. We are a volunteer workforce of over 300,000, and we vote at the highest rate of any demographic age group in the state. We at MRRC are proud of the work we have done to engage our members in voter turnout and advocacy, and we are actively organizing with others in support of this legislation, and we urge you to vote in favor of it. Minnesota's elders are not its past. We are its future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Louise Sundin, and then we have Jim Reed. If you would come forward.
Nice to see you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Louise Sundin, and I am part of here representing the State AFL-CIO Retiree Council and a bunch of retired teacher organizations that I lead. And you know that retired teachers never die. We live longer than other retirees. And my colleagues in the teaching profession are 75% women, and inordinately number of heads of household. We only have ourselves to rely on in retirement and our pensions and savings. So we are very concerned. You've heard the statistics from President Grinna that seniors are not just the largest demographic, but now they're we're more than the school children that we used to teach. I prefer, rather than the silver tsunami, to think of us as maybe a parade coming down every main street and every community in this state, mostly in greater Minnesota. And we're orderly, flag-waving, music-blaring, dancing seniors who are marching into the future, bringing smarts, skills, experience, a whole boatload of experience, talents, and energy. And we, as you may know, don't leave the state. We stay in your communities. We love the state, and we stay here. In order to make sure that our generation will continue to be able to contribute all that knowledge and skill, Minnesota needs to be organized, prepared, focused, and fairly funded, staffed departmentally that will bring city, state, county grants and services together with nonprofits, for-profits, to make it work for all of us in every district in Minnesota, including yours. To be planful, the task force that Representative Cleavorn is advocating and we are supporting strongly will pull together the people, the stats, the outlining the needs of seniors to make strong recommendations for a secure, consolidated, coordinated future for citizens of all ages in Minnesota. I want to tell you my story as an example of the why this examination is so necessary. I, at the moment, have power of attorney for a 50-year friend who is a teacher. She's 87, who is trying to look, I'm trying to look after and keep in her house so that she can age in place.
Ms. Senator,
it's a promise.
Yeah.
I'm trying. It's a promise I made long ago when we were still teaching, she math and me ninth grade English. Now I'm trying to keep that promise. Over the last 3 years, she quickly descended from sundowner syndrome to dementia to Alzheimer's. I am required to arrange for 24/7 care that is excruciatingly expensive. Her financial guy says she may have enough money for 3 years yet. I'm left with the challenge of not just her personal care, but leaking roofs and snow plowing and medical appointments and endless phone calls and so on. When a caregiver doesn't show up, I go out and stay with her. She gets frightened that her hallucinations are trying to poison her, and the phantoms who live in the attic are using all the water and are selling off all the stuff in her house. She refuses to take her meds if she thinks they're the meds that are meant to make her more calm and less combative. I don't mean to sound like I'm whining, but just to illustrate that it's very difficult to research, find, know about all the services available, how to access them, how to afford them, how to make sure that it's all in her best interests and some days I wonder what's in her best interest. So to conclude, these issues all need to be examined, strategically planned, coordinated, with accessible, affordable services available now for all our seniors, not a decade from now. So I want to thank Representative Cleavorn for recognizing the need and her persistence in bringing it to you for consideration and support. The time is of the essence. We can't afford to flub this challenge. The boomers deserve the kind of retirement and end of life they all worked very hard for and saved for. So let's get the show on the road. Hopefully it may even lead to a Department of Aging. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Sundin. And Jim Reed, if you'd like him up. And then we have Sherry Pugh, if she's here. If you'd like to take the chair over there, Ms. Pugh.
Mr. Chair, my name is James Reed, and I'm representing a group I think he's familiar with, the DFL Senior Caucus. Now, we are part of the DFL, but actually we're mostly an independent group operating to see that the lives of seniors improve and that the state take aware of the fact of the wave of seniors that are now needing support, needing attention, and needing the opportunities to survive. The caucus has about 500 members and 10 chapters across the state, so we are growing and rapidly developing organization intending to see seniors do well. We support the formation of this task force, but we do, of course, have some concerns, one of which is that it'll only be for another 3 years that we will hear a final result from the task force. And in between, there will be an election in 2024, which could very much change the directions and interests and objectives. We are also concerned that all of the members that we've already heard from will have the opportunity to testify, and particularly some of our more active groups like Elder Voices, our friends, will get the word out and be able to make the proper effect and communications to this committee and to the task force. We know that we have seniors in the state who are very poor. We know we have seniors who have special needs that may or may not be able to be addressed by this task force. We believe that we should have livable communities where seniors are not warehoused, as unfortunately so often happens. We recognize that the wages of those supporting seniors must be raised and that their opportunities be expanded. We strongly hope that a result of this task force may be the development of a State Department on Aging with a commissioner, a budget, and a professional staff that can lead the legislature and on the needs and abilities of seniors and fully enact the services that this legislature support. So I hope that this task force will go forward. I hope that it will be successful, and in 2025, we will have an opportunity to see a better life for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Thank you. Ms. Pugh?
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Sherry Pugh. As you can see, I'm an older Minnesotan. I live in the town of Mound. I'm on the city council. I was a member of the Board on Aging, and currently I chair Age Friendly Minnesota. And as you've heard from everyone, and I'll try and be brief since many of them said things I would say, that there is now the time to address the senior issue or aging issue in the state of Minnesota. Age Friendly is a collaboration. It's a statewide effort. We were created in December of 2019 through an executive order signed by Governor Walsh. And that committee is comprised of eight state agency representatives and six advocates who represent the faith community advocacy and the tribal communities in the state of Minnesota. Our task is to help Minnesota do better and use its creative efforts to make Minnesota age-friendly, both physically and physical environments, and not so much service, but looking at how do we make our community such. Last year in the state legislature, you gave us some money to do a grant program. We put out requests. We were very thoughtful and made sure that we got out to all the little counties throughout the state, because we know our seniors in greater Minnesota have significant challenges and barriers. We even created a grant of technical people to help people write grants. Those grants are due today, but as of last night, over 100 grants had been submitted, asking for over $9 million. There is innovation, there is thought out in every one of your communities about how we can make this state an age-friendly state. As the Age-Friendly Council, we are collecting data, resources. We're trying to create a practice, best practices book. And we also participate in a national collaborative of 10 other states that are doing what they call master plans in aging. We see that our role in this bill authored by Representative Claiborne is like Dr. Gogler said, we will be a part of it. We will bring resources to it and energy. And since I need to wrap up, I'll share this, and I say this to my son. People thought that the baby boomers were a big collaborative. He's a millennial. There's more of them, and they're only 30 years away. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Buell. And Representative Kosnick, I think you had a question of Mr. McFarland or Mishifsky, I believe.
Well, to any of the testifiers or maybe just the author, you know, I think it's great to see a lot of activity here with our senior Minnesotans. I enjoy when I am able to visit with a lot in my district. And I think the intent in that of the bill has some merit. I'm just trying to understand and quick digging what our budget is, and I haven't been successful with the Minnesota Board of Aging what their current budget is, but a lot of what I'm hearing is already listed on their website as a lot what I think is trying to be encompassed, but I understand and I hear the testimony that it seems to be not coordinated that well. So I'm trying to figure out if spending another $250,000 really addresses the problem. Maybe we need to refocus within the Board of Aging, because it's already pretty, what I'm hearing from testimony and what I'm seeing as their directive, a legislative directive currently, just needs to do a better job rather than continuing to grow government. A lot of the grants, there's millions of dollars within that program under the Department of Human Services. So I'm just kind of missing the disconnect there and wondering if this is the appropriate step. And I know we've talked about this in previous years, but we have newer members here. So help me kind of understand that, either to the author or to some of the testifiers that are under there. It's a 25-member board already that is tasked with doing a lot of this work. I can't find who the governor appoints the chair. I don't know who that is, who the staff person is, but maybe it's an opportunity to just refine and refocus on what we're doing there is what my question is.
Would you Mr. Like to address it first, and then I'll follow up.
Mr. Chairman, members, the Board on Aging was organized in 1954. I've been on the board for 8 years now. And the board is, what the board does is laid out in federal and state statute. And so I think one of the reasons we want to do the task force is we want to examine how all these pieces fit together, because we started in 1954, we've layered on all these regulations and rules over the years. And as one of your previous testifiers said, it's hard to get your arms around it. You know, it takes a long time to figure out who's doing what in the system, and that's why we want to do a deep dive and study the whole system.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I could, my question is, what are we spending right now on the Board of Aging currently? I unfortunately haven't been able to research that real quick here, but if we have that information, I'm just kind of curious, how much are we spending there compared to adding another $250,000 if that
Chair.
Even fixes the issue?
Yeah. Representative Kosnick, I appreciate the question. I think it's a really good one, which is one of the reasons that we're laying the bill over so we can continue to have those conversations since we didn't have the fiscal note. But what I want the committee members and the public to understand is this legislation was brought to me several years ago, not the legislation, but the idea of the legislation, because the Board of Aging was tasked with giving guidance and to lead the effort. And as Ms. Shitsky testified earlier, they're volunteers. This is a part-time thing that they do, but they were unable to have the staff, the resources to gather the information, to provide the information to us as legislators or to the governor's team. So the idea of this task force is to have a real concerted, how did we hear it earlier, an integrated and coordinated effort. And when you think about the millions of dollars, or maybe even billions of dollars that we spend on our aging communities, the cost to do this task force and to make sure that we're spending those monies where they're needed is pittance. So it is important that we are using those resources that we allocate here at the legislature appropriately. And I think that is why we need to spend this small amount of money. Ms. Shitsky, did you want to say something else?
I would like to add the money that funds, I'm sorry, this is Mary Jo Shitsky, MBA member. The money that funds the MBA is a percentage of the money that comes from the Older Americans Act funding that comes from the federal government. And honestly, board members are unclear of the actual operating budget for the MBA. We ask, I have asked over 3.5 years, but I know it's a significant percentage of millions of dollars that goes through the Department of Human Services and then is accessed by the MBA executive director, whose name is Carrie Benson, and by the acting board chair, whose name is Maureen Schneider, and the rest of us get paid for attending meetings.
I think we should dispel with any future questions right now on this particular bill, because we have Representative Elkins that has a bill.
That's correct. And the bill is being laid over.
But there needs to be more discussion. And one thing, Representative Claiborne, I hope we'll look at is including the Department of Veterans Affairs in this as well. We have issues with veterans that need to be addressed.
I would like to just address that question really quickly, and then I will step aside and let Representative Elkins present his bill. The idea of the task force is to be a body, much like a listening group, to go and do the investigation and to listen. And of course, veterans would be at the table expressing their concerns, just as the Department of Health would be there, just as the Department of Human Services would be there to testify and to bring their issues forward. The task force was intentionally kept small so that work could actually get done and that it wouldn't be so large as to become unable of doing its work. But all voices are welcomed at the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. And House File 979 is laid over for possible inclusion. And while Representative Elkins is coming up, it's not lost on me that the only octogenarian in the legislature was asked to fill in. Okay. Representative Elkins, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself, and then if you would, we'll go ahead with House File 480.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Steve Elkins, and I have with me Trevor Turner, the head of the Minnesota Council on Disabilities, who will be testifying very brief. We're going to keep this very quick. So the motion here will be to refer this bill back to the funding committee, which is Department of Human Services Finance.
Okay, so I move House File 480, and Mr. Turner, if you'd like to proceed with your testimony, please.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Trevor Turner, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. The Minnesota Council on Disability supports House File 480. It's a constituent-initiated bill that would provide funding for MCD to empower local government with the tools and training needed to ensure that their digital presence is accessible to Minnesotans with disabilities. Buildings need wheelchair accessible ramps, and public signs need Braille alternative text. So does our public digital infrastructure need to be accessible to everyone. The digital realm is no longer a privilege for some, it's a right to all. Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act and Chapter 363A of the Minnesota Human Rights Act mandate that our government and its services be accessible for everyone, and that must include websites as well. Much of the government business nowadays is conducted online, and the past 3 years made explicitly clear how important digital access is for local governments and their residents to interact with each other, ranging from snow emergency alerts to informational videos on public health, applying for permits, paying taxes and fines, and most importantly, participating in local civic discourse. Accessible government, especially digital government, allows for people with disabilities to live independently in the communities of their choice. As a person who is deafblind, I personally understand how important website accessibility to the online experience. If a government website is incompatible with high contrast features or screen readers, it completely excludes the blind and low vision community. So due to budget constraints and limited resources, many small cities, towns, and counties are unable to dedicate funds to ensure that their websites are accessible. This can lead to underrepresentation of disability issues in local government because Minnesotans are unable to engage with their local officials. It can also be dangerous because Minnesotans with disabilities may miss local emergency alerts and not have access to critical emergency phone numbers and points of contact. Inaccessible websites can cause insurmountable barriers in paying fees, taxes, and fines to local government that use websites to conduct these services. The need is tremendous, but this bill is a step forward in the right direction. We appreciate the support of Representative Elkins and this committee on this bill, and we will continue to engage with stakeholders, including local governments and advocates, to ensure that their websites are accessible for all. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
I'm here for questions. And Representative Elkins, I didn't give you the opportunity to explain your bill, but if you could do that briefly.
Yes.
And I know Representative Nash has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, basically what this bill does is it provides funding to the Minnesota Council on Disabilities to hire a couple of people for the specific purpose of assisting small cities and counties to make their websites and other digital assets accessible pursuant to the American Disabilities Act. So governments are bound by the ADA as well, and for our digital presences as well. Many of the small cities and counties just don't have the know-how in order to make their websites in particular more accessible, even though the capabilities are generally there latent within their tools. They need some hand-holding on how to do that.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Nash.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mr. Chair. We might actually agree on something here today, Representative Elkins. Write that down. Having been in technology for a lot of years and having heard a lot of the people who are concerned about this, this is a worthy effort, but I think you've left some notable exclusions. There is no mention of townships in your bill here at all. You're only relying on counties and cities. And as somebody who has a fair number of townships in my county, you might want to throw them in there because they have web pages and they have people who would like to access their government digitally as well. So I hope you would address that exclusion in your bill, Representative Elkins, because sound piece of advice is you never want the townships on your bad side. So I think that, I mean, the price seems a little spendy. It's $500,000, but I do think that in order to conform government to make sure that people who have the need to interact with us have the technological ability to do so is a worthy effort, but would really admonish you to fix some of the holes.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick.
Well, can I respond?
Yes,
real quick. So the bill, the purpose is to support all local governments. The League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties are mentioned by name because they have on their staffs the technical expertise to assist with this effort. So Mel Reeder from the League of Minnesota Cities, Zacharias from the Minnesota County Technology Leadership Association have been actively involved in developing this.
And Mr. Chair, just briefly, townships do also have some capabilities, and you should at least put them in there to make sure you're interacting with them because they understand the needs of their folks quite well and will have the ability to add to your conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
And Representative Kosnick, before you start, if Mr. Lightfoot, if you'd like to come forward, we'll have one more testifier, and then we'll have you ask your question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just provide very brief comments. My name is Daniel Lightfoot. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. We represent 837 cities across the state of Minnesota, and just want to appreciate Representative Elkin's work on this bill and our work with the Minnesota Council on Disability to address this important issue. Technology presents, obviously, a great opportunity for cities to provide information to residents, but it also creates challenges in ensuring that information is accessible to all residents. To make matters more challenging, the technology used by residents and the technology used for a city website itself is constantly changing, which is why the resources to support direct and ongoing Minnesota Council on Disabilities training for cities is important. We certainly know that oftentimes the website framework that a city has itself is accessible, but the information on that website and displayed on that website, like forms to request services, council minutes, city policies and ordinances and agendas, oftentimes are not, which is why training is so important. We view this bill as a critical first step in providing additional resources and training for city staff to ensure that pertinent city information is accessible to all residents. We also hope that in addition to the training resources to support cities and counties and townships, with ongoing support, we hope that this bill will be a good first step in providing some additional resources to smaller, less resource cities that may need to spend some local resources in ensuring that their website and the content on it is accessible. There is a letter in your packet co-signed by the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties in support of this bill. And thanks, Representative Elkins, for your work on this, and happy to stand for questions as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lightfoot. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins, I remember hearing this bill a couple years back, and I think at that time one of the sticking points was an ongoing appropriation, and I see in here in line 1.2 this is a one-time appropriation, so I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got something that's probably a sufficient need and a role of the state government to help our local cities and townships and counties to do that. So I might not be opposed.
Appreciate that.
That sounds positive. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to Representative Elkins for bringing the bill forward, as well as Mr. Lightfoot and Mr. Turner for being here today. To kind of recenter us and bring us back to the last bill we just heard, we were talking about how as much as a third of our elderly may have some form of disabilities. And certainly one of the things in technology that we talk about all the time is how we make government work for real people. And I think that there are many of us on this committee who are very passionate about that particular task. And this bill does exactly that, right? It helps us train cities, counties, and hopefully townships to do exactly that work to make sure things are accessible for real folks in our communities. So I want to say thank you for that. Technology brings tremendous opportunities and sometimes tremendous shortfalls, and hopefully this bill will help fill in some of those gaps. So just wanted to say thank you for the bill and for the work, and let's hope that we can get it done.
Thank you. If there are no more questions, I see we have one person in the audience that would like to come up. Mr. Eller, if you'd like to come forward, please. Please identify yourself and be very brief, as we are out of time.
Yes, committee, state government, finance policy, again, committee today, February 6th, in room 10, that does not have closed captioning in the room.
Please.
My name is Rick Heller, unofficially represented Twice Eligible, also could be known as Twice Exceptional and Print-Related Disability. In 2018, the Act of Congress approved the Matrice Treaty, took blindness and print disability, only two types of people found under the federal act called the Higher Education Opportunity Act 2008 that are handicapped. They merged them. Now they're called eligible. They moved the bar down also for the people with print disabilities. I do support this bill. and 480. I would ask the Association of Minnesota Community Counties check the accessibility of their own document. 2 years ago, they were sued by NOAA.
I think we're going to be
anyhow.
You should discuss this with the association
and Pacific.
This isn't the proper forum.
And then
so with this, I'm
and then specifically, sir, at discretion of the chair, I would like to point out one thing about this bill, what it lacks. And I know you can't do amendments, but this is what it needs. If we're going to use state and local agencies, minimally what we need to do, if they commit, they create a web page, functionally accessible, identifying digital accessibility with a statement and a date on it. Because if you don't put it in statute, I have no idea if the Minnesota Council on Disability will be able to enforce that people use our state dollars. They won't make people worry about what digital accessibility means for the eligible people. That's what's missing. Those who can scribe a note at any next meeting or bring it up, but there has to be some feedback, not just a report, about these people that are using our dollars and how they're going to meet those eligible people.
Okay, Ms. Cutler, I have to cut you off. Now, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 480 be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. There being no further business before the committee,
we need to call vote.
Oh, we need to vote. Yeah. Sorry. I'm so anxious to get out of here. All in favor of moving House File 480 to the Human Services Finance Committee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Good. We are adjourned. Thank you.